Okay, so we are holding on Gimel Amud Beis, 10 lines from the top. There's two lines in a row, 9 lines from the top, 8 lines, check that. There's two lines in a row that begin cool, the second one. Okay. So now we have a question. We talked to the Mishnah, we have the various sizes of walls, 6 for God, for grill, 5 for Godless, etc. Hain v'sidon, ajoma hain v'loy sidon. These measurements that we're talking about in the Mishnah, does that include the plaster you put on the wall?
Or not. Meaning, in other words, for example, let's say a wall of bricks, 3 tefachim wide.
Plastered or unplastered?
Does it mean, it's a given that you have to plaster it, especially Mepharshim point out, especially if we're talking about, some Mepharshim say that we're talking about regardless what the wall was made out of, even if it's made out of stone, it was common to plaster it. Other than I'm saying, we're talking about primarily the last two, the kind that are made out of half bricks or whole bricks, where bricks are made out of mud, and therefore they dissolve in the rain after a while, so you want to put some plaster on them to help preserve them a little longer. The point of the question is, let's say, for example, the half-brick wall, the kvisin wall, let's say, it's supposed to be 4 tefachim wide, each one gives 2 tefachim of space from the chaser. Is that they're actually giving 2 tefachim exactly, meaning that the kvisin wall itself is a little bit less than 4, but once you add the plaster, it's full 4? Or does it mean the wall itself is 4? Once you add the plaster, you have another couple of inches on both sides. So Nachman Yitzchok says, it's logical to say that the amounts in our Mishnah include the plaster. Why? Because if you're going to say that it doesn't include the plaster, listen to the Shurit, and the Mishnah should say, for example, by a wall of Kvisin, instead of saying that each one gives 2 tefachim, it should say they give 2.1 or whatever it is. Yeah.
It seems logical that it includes the plaster.
That includes the plaster. In other words, the actual wall itself of Kvisin is a bit less than 4 tefachim wide. And then once you add the plaster, then you have full 4 tefachim. Because otherwise, the Mishnah should have said so. Otherwise, the Mishnah should have said that each one gives, for example, 2.1 or 2.2 or whatever it is.
Plaster the wall.
And that's what we're saying. It was normal to plaster the wall, yeah. Okay, Elolav Shema Minohein V'Sidon. Shouldn't that prove, therefore, that it means that that it includes the wall as well as the plaster? The Gemara answers, Loi, not necessarily. Lo'olam Emolachein V'Loi Sidon. No, because I could answer that maybe it does mean that you don't include the plaster. Hello. We did, because we didn't know you were coming. But we only just started it. Anyway.
We didn't miss anything. We're doing it from home.
Oh, well, good. Okay. So,
you did a story about Horvitz yet?
Not yet. We're going to get to that today.
Oh. We just did that on the way here.
Oh, okay.
Could I say that we're ahead of you?
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. Beautiful. Look at this.
Okay. All right. No. Okay, so we were just starting to ask. The Gemara is asking the question: is the plaster included in the numbers that we say in the Mishnah or not? So Rav Nachman Yitzchak has said that yes, presumably because otherwise the Mishnah should have mentioned it. Okay, so the Gemara says loy, not necessarily. Maybe you could say that the amounts in the Mishnah don't include the plaster. But Kivin, do I have a tefach loytani? Just since it's less than a tefach, the Mishnah doesn't bother mentioning it. Yes, you are meant to understand for yourself that, for example, a kvisin wall with its plaster is not 4 tefachim, it's 4.1 or 4.2, and therefore that you're going to have to be giving 2.1 or 2.2 or whatever it is tefachim. But the Mishnah didn't bother mentioning fractions like that. Question is loy. What do you mean? The Mishnah does mention fractions. For example, it mentions that with bricks, each one has to provide a tefach and a half of space.
So
you see, it does mention fractions. The answer is, Hasam Chazi leads to Rufi. Yes, but the difference is, there you have two half tefachim that make up one whole tefach. The total wall is 3 tefachim. Each one of them is going to give 1.5. So those halves are worth mentioning because two of them together are going to make one full tefach. As opposed to here, you're talking about, it's not worth mentioning because you're going to talk about an etzba or two. It's not even going to make up a full tefach, even if you combine the plaster on both sides. So you still can't prove one way or the other. Toshma, come, although let's try to prove from another place. In Masechta Eruvin, we learned, this was going back a few years, there's two ways to make a mavui permissible to carry in on Shabbos. Aside from the fact that you have to make a shidduch mavoyus, which we're not dealing with, you either have to put up a vertical pole near the end of it, called a lehi, or a horizontal beam across the top of it, called a kora. The kora, if you're going to do that, has a minimum width. Toshma, a kora sha'amru, this kora that we're talking about, has to be rechava k'dei lekabel ariach. It has to be wide enough to put an ariach on top of it. And what is an ariach? Ma'ariach chatzi levena shel gimel tefachim. An ariach is a half of a 3 tefach brick.
Of 3 tefachim.
So l'chora you see the brick itself is 3. Meaning that l'chora you see the brick itself is 3. So therefore, for example, the brick wall of our Mishnah would be 3 plus the plaster.
We should have 1.5 then.
Same difference. The point is, in other words, right, no, so the coda itself only needs to be a tefach wide because, okay, a little bit of the stone can, a little bit of the brick can stick out on either side of it. That's not the problem. That's not a problem. The point is, though, that we're specifically saying that it means that, that a normal brick is 3 tefachim wide. Well, then, applying that to our Mishnah, that would mean the actual brick itself is 3 tefachim wide, and once you add the plaster, you have a little more than 3 tefachim. The answer is the Gemara says no.
So here we would say,
in other words, the wall of our Mishnah, for example, is not 3 tefachim, it's 3.1 or whatever.
Because here we say 3 tefachim. And it's a little more?
No. They were saying that a standard brick consists of 3 tefachim. That's
right.
What it sounds like.
Yeah.
So in that case, in our Mishnah, then the bricks themselves are 3 tefachim plus the plaster. You're going to have a little more. The opposite of what Rav Nachman was saying.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's not excluded.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Right.
The answer is no. Hasan Berav Ravasa. No, we can answer that Mishnah is talking about larger bricks. It's not all bricks. Bricks were basically about to be amos, but not exactly. So you have larger ones and you have smaller ones. There, it's talking about a larger brick. But our Mishnah could well be talking about the normal size one. The normal size ones are designed so that once you put up a wall of them and put plaster on it, they will come out to It will come out to 3 tefachim exactly. Over there, we could be talking about the ones that are made to begin with, where the bricks themselves are three wide. I think what's the dekanami? In fact, we can prove that from the wording of the Mishnah there. Dekatani shall shlosh tefachim, because the Mishnah finds it necessary to say specifically that the brick is of 3 tefachim wide. Miklal de ikazutra, implying that there are smaller ones out there, such as the ones in our Mishnah. Shlamino, that proves it. Okay, Tosfos asks in that case, why don't we say the other way around? We could answer that the Mishnah over there is talking about the standard ones, and ours is talking about larger ones. The answer is because then in that case, the Mishnah didn't have to mention. We would assume, especially because we're talking about over there Eruvin, which is a Din de Rabbanan, we would assume we use the smallest possible size brick. So if the Mishnah didn't specify, we would assume it means the ones that are 2.9, so that once you add plaster, you have 3, rather than the ones that are 3. In order, only if the Mishnah wants to tell us, no, this is an exception, we're going to use larger bricks, does it have to specify. But that implies that we're talking over there about larger bricks.
That we can say,
and therefore that's the halacha in the case of our Mishnah. The walls of our Mishnah are designed that the amount of space we're talking about is including the plaster. So neither one of them has to give more than 3 or 2.5 or 2 or what have you, tefachim of space. Okay? Now we're going to digress a little bit to talk about the dinim of rebuilding a shul. What's the connection? Mefoshim say, because we mentioned before, we talked yesterday about the greatness of the second Beis Mikdash over the first one, that it was taller, that it lasted longer. We're going to end up talking a little bit further on Dalet Amud Aleph. We're going to talk about Hurdus's renovation of the second Beis Mikdash. So in order to, as an introduction to that, we're going to talk about the dinim, what are the dinim as far as renovating a shul. Some of the Foshim, by the way, say the reason why the Gemara wants to bring this in. We mentioned the pasuk Gadol Yih Habayis Ha'Achron Min Harishon. So we talked yesterday about Ha'Achron has a dual meaning in the second Beis Mikdash, but it also is hinting at the third one. Yes, but there is also some of the Foshim point out it was also meant to hint. The words Hazer Ha'Achron are meant to hint that the second Beis Mikdash itself is going to have two phases. Hazeh, this one that you're building right now in the time of the beginning, and Ha'achron, the one that's going to be built later on, renovated, namely Hurdus's, which, as the Gemara is going to say, was one of the most beautiful buildings there ever was. So, the Gemara says, Amar Chista, Leilistu Inish Beik Nishta, a person should not tear down a shul. Leilistu Inish Beik Nishta, ad the bunny Beik Nishta Achri. A person should not tear down one shul unless he first builds its replacement shul. What is the reason? Ikadami mishum pshiyosa. Some say the reason is because of pshia. What might happen? And pshia doesn't necessarily mean they might deliberately not. Rashi says there might happen an onus, such as, for example, we're going to talk soon, pidyon shvuyim or something. And now they're because of the onus, you know, it got delayed, and therefore they're going to end up not doing it. Other mafreshim say maybe it doesn't mean so much they may not do it, but they may take their time over it.
Really?
Yeah, that's one reason. The ikadami mishum salui. The other reason is partially because you need a place to daven. Where are you going to daven while the shul is being renovated, while the shul is torn down and being rebuilt? The Gemara says, "My benayo, what's the practical difference between these two reasons?" The answer is ikabenayo di ikab beik nishtachriti. And here we have two girsos. That's why we have beik nishtachriti in parentheses. The difference would be, suppose that there is an beik nishtachriti means another shul in town. There's a different girsa, which it says on the side, duchdil tzaluye, if there's a place to daven. Meaning, basically, it boils down to, does there need to be an actual another shul available, or is it enough if there's a place that's available to daven, even if it's not a full-fledged shul? So therefore, in other words, the matter of Kshirosa still applies. They may get careless, or they may forget, or take their time or whatever and not build the new shul, because they figure they have another one available. Whereas Mishum Saluye, they have another place to daven. So the Gemara tells, Maremo Mazutra, Sasri Ubonu Be Kaita Besitva, Ubonu Be Sitra Be Kaita. Maremo and Mazutra did as follows. They had, so Be Kaita means the summer house, and Be Sitra means the winter house. Rashi describes like this. They had two different ways of building a shul. They had a winter shul and a summer shul. The winter shul would have a lower building. It had thicker walls and fewer windows, so that it would be a nice warm building. And the summer shul was the other way around. They'd have larger windows. It would be built
the upper one.
No, not necessarily the upper. We're not talking upper and lower necessarily. According to most, Tosfos brings one possibility over here that maybe we're talking about actually one shul, some other Rishonim talk about that it may have been one shul that they renovated to turn it from a winter to a summer shul or vice versa.
Going from the basement to the aliyah.
No, not going from the basement to the aliyah, but rather, in other words, they would build it a certain way for the winter, and then towards the end of the winter, they'd make holes in the walls or whatever to rebuild it for the summer, and then go as needed. So some Mephoshim explain like that, and then that way they explain that's the point of what the Gemara is saying. Since the building is available the whole time, they can continue davening in it. Then there's no problem of Pshiyosa or of Saluya, and therefore it's allowed. Most other Mephoshim explain that they were two different buildings.
Which makes more sense.
In which case...
Otherwise, there would be no question.
Well, not necessarily... Okay, but... fine. But some of them say that that's the point. Only in that way can you do it. Only if you actually have it available.
Okay.
So, right. But according to the explanation that they were different buildings, then there's a lot of different possibilities. First of all, Tosfos says that it may be, as the Gemara is going to say soon, that if you find that the building is in danger of collapse, then you're allowed to tear it down even if you don't have another shul, et cetera, because you have to. This might have been the same kind of thing. It might have been that they saw that the building is structurally unsound. Or, Tosfos says, the fact is you do have the other shul available. Let's say, for example, during the winter, when they're tearing down and rebuilding the summer shul, fine. And if it comes the summer and the summer shul is not ready yet, fine. They can still continue to daven in the winter shul. It won't be as comfortable, but still. Or Tosfos says another possibility, as you're talking, each season lasts 6 months. That's plenty of time to be able to build another one. There's various other Rishonim that talk about various other nuances in it. For example, one possibility, I think the Rosh talks about, maybe on the contrary, maybe the other way around. If there's another full-fledged shul available, maybe that's more reason not to, because then people are likely to get careless. Well, we have another shul already. Why should we bother? Whereas over here, the other shul is so uncomfortable to daven in the wrong season that they're gonna get on with it and finish the other one. I'm a little bit in a lot of action. Govu zuzi umachti mai. Now, what happens, for example, you're telling me... So you have all those various explanations of what it meant exactly. What happens? You're telling me you can't tear down a shul unless its replacement is already built. What about if you already have the money already? What are you going to say then? Is there a problem of shiosa? Is there a problem if they're going to get careless? Yes, because what happens if there comes up a situation of pidyon shvuyim? And they'll give away the money for that, and now they don't have the money to rebuild the shul. He asks him, what about Shrigi Livni? What about if you have, not just you have the money available, you have all the building materials already, you have all the bricks are set up in piles ready to go, the Hadri Hudri, and you have the roof beams are all prepared and all sanded down and all shaped to be ready, your Machti Kshuri, and all the other beams of it, all the other woodwork of it is all sitting there waiting to be used. My, then what's the thing? Well, would you be allowed to? You prepare all the building materials for the new shul, then tear down the old shul, and then start rebuilding the new one.
So where are they going to daven then?
So let's say they have another place to daven. Let's say they have Duch D'Achritu, like we said, they have another place. Amalei. So he answers him still. Zimnin de mischami lo pidyon shvuyim. Still, it could happen that there'll be a situation of pidyon shvuyim. Mizabni v'yavi lo, and they'll go sell all those building materials and use that to raise the money. Okay, so then Ravin asks him, by that logic, what are you going to say? I mean, you could say the same thing even if they built the new shul. So even if you built the new shul, don't tear down the old one because they may end up having to sell the new shul. Now, Tosfos learns that we are talking about specifically until they daven it, which leads various Rishonim to talk about what would be, are we saying that once
they
daven, meaning in other words, before they actually started using it to daven in, Ravina is asking, Lechura, couldn't they go and sell it at that point? Now, what does that mean to imply? Does that mean to imply once they started using the new shul for davening, they're not allowed to sell it even for pidyon shvuyim? The Rambam, in fact, holds that way. Other Rishonim say not necessarily. Maybe even conceivably they could. The Gemara is going to say, practically speaking, they won't. But halacha, they could, but practically speaking, they probably won't. As opposed to before they daven, but still. Fine, but if like people don't sell their actual house, once the shul is already built, even if they haven't davened in it yet, practically speaking, they're not going to go and sell it. Again, once they davened in it, according to the Rambam, they can't sell it, halacha. But even before they started davening in it, practically speaking, they're not going to.
Even if the yachid davens, or...
No, we're talking about a minyan. We're talking about a shul for the tzibur, yeah. Okay. The Gemara says, all these rules that we're talking about not tearing down a shul until you have its replacement ready, v'loya moron, ella d'loy chazi b'tzuha. Now, all this only applies if you didn't see that there's some kind of structural weakness in it. Tzuha literally means cracks. So like you see, the walls are cracked and it's gonna collapse at once. That you can't tear down the old one until the new one is ready.
If you see a crack, you can tear it down.
But if you see cracks in the shul, safsuri avani, then yes, you can tear down the old one and build it even if there's no replacement in yet, because you got it, or otherwise it's gonna collapse.
Well, obviously it has to be a crack that's subject to
cause. We're not talking about the plaster as a little crack, we're talking about a structural crack, come on. As we find an example that Rav Ashi one time saw cracks in the shul of Masa Machasya, the town where he lived, Sasre, so he tore down...
In Babel,
yeah. It's a suburb of Sura.
Which is?
It's in southern Iraq. Sasre, so he tore down the building, but to make sure that it gets built again as fast as possible, he brought his bed in there. From now on, he was going to sleep in there, because Rashi says this way, he'll make sure to get it done as fast as possible, because otherwise he's sleeping out in the sun and the rain and whatever, there's no roof over his head. And he kept his bed there, he didn't take his bed out, until even the rain gutters were put onto the building, meaning the last final touches, and only then did he go back to live at home. Which leads Tosfos to the question, how are you allowed to do that? You're not allowed to sleep in a shul.
Right.
So Tosfos discusses, it doesn't matter, I mean, it's being built as a shul.
Is it considered a shul?
So Tosfos answers maybe he didn't put his bed literally in the shul itself, but rather next to it, like in a side room, like in one of the side rooms of the shul.
All the people were sleeping in terms of
sleep. Yeah, okay.
That's the base of Medrash. Yeah,
that's the base of Medrash. The base of Medrash is a little bit different. The Talmud Chachamim are allowed to.
Also, the private shul.
In this case, yes, that's true, because Ravashi was the one responsible for it. I don't know. Yeah, it's owned by a Goch, I don't know. Okay, anyway. There is a number of other Rishonim give a different answer. They say, where you're sleeping in there for the covenant of the shul, you're allowed to. In this case, Ravashi is doing it for the covenant of the shul, so it'll be rebuilt as fast as possible. And this comes up, for example, in Halacha. For example, as far as the din, let's say, are you allowed to sleep, Yom Kippur night in shul instead of going home? Yes, because it's part of the covenant of that you're staying there, the covenant Yom Kippur. So therefore, there's a hatchet for it.
You're not allowed to keep doing the rabbit direction.
No.
Okay.
Onward. Okay. So, given all of this that we said about that you're not allowed to tear down a shul until the replacement is built, then you have to ask, in that case, how did Bava ben Buta give advice to Hurdus, as we'll see at the bottom of the Amud and then in the next Amud, how did he give advice to Hurdus to tear down and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash? What about Rav Chista's din? Now, Mefarshim point out, you know, an obvious difference is the Beis HaMikdash has to be built in a certain spot. A shul, you can just rebuild a replacement shul someplace else. But then they explain, the point of the Gemara's question is, instead of Bava ben Buta telling Hurdus, tear down the entire thing and then start, you want to renovate it, fine. Do it piecemeal. Tear down one wall and rebuild it, then another, et cetera. Don't do it all at once.
What was the condition when he said that?
We're going to see. That's what we're going to answer. One answer is that Bava ben Buta saw that there were cracks and structural deficiencies in it. By the time Hurdus renovated the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, it was over 300 years old. So it was long overdue for some reconstruction, I guess. Or another answer, Mahusa Shiny Delehadrabe. It's different when a king is doing the work. Once a king is committed to a certain project, he doesn't go back on it. D'omar Shmuel, as Shmuel said, famous expression, Y'omar Machusa Akanaturi, even if a king says, I will rip a mountain out, Akaturi, he'll rip the mountain out. Vallejo Debe, he's not going to go back on his word because once he's committed to a project, he has the resources and whatever to see it through. This is
the king
No, the Pashas were talking about a Goyish king also. That once they commit to it, you know, we're not talking about a politician who just says it
Horace was not Jewish.
No, he was. He was an Evid. He's an Evid.
He's a quasi-Jew,
as we shall
but
say.
No, but was he an Evid that was from a Goyish?
He's an Evid Kanani. He has a din of an Evid Kanani.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He wasn't Jewish.
But he's quasi-Jewish, then. He has a dinim. He has the mitzvahs that are obligatory.
I didn't say he wasn't quasi-Jewish.
Okay. Whatever, fine. Going back a second, by the way, to Rav Ashi sleeping in the shul over there until it gets done, Mefarshim points out that Amman writes that if it's necessary to do that, if you see that a shul is structurally unsound and you need to rebuild it, you have to work on it night and day so it gets done as fast as possible. Mefarshim say that Amman got that small Gemara over here. You see Rav Ashi even slept there, so that, this way, you can make sure the building should continue even by night. Okay. Well, when they have to build in his particular area, of course. Okay. Anyway,
let me ask you a question. According to that thinking, the shul that were burned by the Nazis should have all been rebuilt?
No, we're saying if you have a reason that a shul has to be rebuilt, you should make sure that the new one is built before the old one is destroyed. If the old one got destroyed by the Goyim, there's dinim about it, what to do in the case of a destroyed shul, but not necessarily are you obligated to rebuild it. If there's no Jews living in that area, what are you rebuilding it for? No, if you don't have the resources to rebuild it, then you don't. The Gemara and Megillah say in that case, what you should do is the place gets overgrown with grass. You should cut the grass and leave it there, and that way it causes agnas nefesh. People will say, there's a destroyed shul here. We should really get our act together and rebuild it. But if there's no Jewish community there anymore, no, talk about it. Okay. Anyway, so yeah. This expression, by the way, Amma Marka Okartura, is brought in many places in Chiddush to illustrate the idea, among other things, it's meant to illustrate the idea that with human beings you have to at least say something in order for something to be accomplished, whereas Hashem can think something and already it's accomplished. That, and we also talk about it in connection with Wachachila River, that it be like a king and overcome all the obstacles and rip out mountains if you have to, etc. So, what's the background for the story of Hurdus? Like this. Hurdus Abed the base Chashmonoi. Hurdus was an Eved of the family of the Chashmonoi. An Eved Kanani, yeah. Josephus actually describes what happened was the Yochanan Kohen Gadol, one of the middle Chashmonoim, conquered the area of Edom, which is more or less not so much Edom of Tanakh, but also modern day southern Eretz Yisrael, like Hebron and that area, or whatever, where a lot of Edomim had settled. And Josephus writes that he forced them to become Jews. In what we see, what we see from our Gemara is he made them into avodim, forced them in the sense that a person becomes an Eved Kanani, he's obligated to accept Shevet Mitzvot Bnei Noach. That's what it means. Not Shevet Mitzvot Bnei. He's obligated to do Milo Tevila, as we learned all about it in Gittin, and in Yevamos, he has to do Milo and Tevila and accept Mitzvot Mitzvot. It was in Rambam Shlosh HaPrakim recently also. So that's what it means, evidently. So all of them were avodim. Yeah. So, Nosen Eina Bo'isa Tinoikis. So he forced them all to become avodim kanim. Yeah. Okay, so Hurdus was a descendant of these people. Okay. Hurdus cast his eyes on a certain young lady from the family of the Chashmonoim. He wanted to marry her. And Marsha points out, it's not just that he was attracted to her beauty or whatever it is, it's also because we learned in Gittin, in connection with Avodim Kananim, that one way an Eved Kanani can go free is if his master marries a Mokta, a Bas Yisrael. So he figured if he'll marry this girl, not just if he marries a Mokta, a Bas Yisrael, sorry, if the Eved marries somebody from their master's family, well, in this case, Hashmonoim is his master, and he marries a woman from that family, automatically he'll be free. Yoimachad Shamahu Gavra Baskola, one day that man, meaning Hurdus, heard a Basko, the Omar, which said, Ko Avda the Morid Hashta Maslach. Any Eved who rebels at this time will be successful. The Ramban, by the way, has a long thing about it in Parshas Vayechi, that the Chashmonoim deserved punishment for the fact that they had taken over the kingship, which was illegal. They were from Shevet Levi. The kingship is supposed to be reserved for Shevet Yehuda.
What are the other reasons why they did wrong?
Well, there's that. There's also the later Chashmonoim had become Tzedukim.
Kohanim cannot become kings.
According to the Ramban, at least, yes. The Ramban apparently disagrees with that, because the Ramban writes that part of the aftermath of the story of Hanukkah is that kingship returned to the Jewish people, so apparently the Ramban sees it in a positive light. Anyway, okay.
He didn't resent that, I don't think.
Okay, no, it returned until the Churban. Until the Churban, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't support the Ramban or such
a thing. No, it did, for that 200 years, they had a Jewish kingship. Come Kaplina Lakula Marvase, so Hordus arose and killed all of his masters. He wiped out the entire family of the Hashmonaim. The Shire Lahi Yanukta, however, he left over that girl that he was attracted to. When this girl, this young lady, saw that he wanted to marry her, she went up to the roof, she called out in a loud voice, Amra, and she made the famous announcement, from now on, if anybody claims to be from the family of Hashmonaim, Abdu, who is really an Eved, he's descended from Hordus. Because the only one left from the family is that girl, meaning me, and that girl has fallen from the roof to the ground, and Shitaka fell down, and Shitaka fell down and died. No, it's not necessarily against halacha. Actually, there are mepharshim who point out that maybe she had a valid reason. The fact is, Hordus is going to force her into a marriage. When a person is in a situation where sometimes when a person
is in the Gibbon in
one
jumps off the ship.
That's true.
But look what Esther.
She wouldn't have wanted to go into it in the first place, Mordechai realized that that a tzedekah, I guess, they wouldn't have gotten into this situation if there wasn't something great destined to come out of it, and therefore she didn't feel that there was anything destined great to come out of it. Okay, let's continue. Tumna Sheva Shonin Bedruksha. Well, Hordus took the body and preserved it for 7 years in honey. Ikadami Bala, some say that having preserved the body in honey, he then satisfied his desires, had relations with her. The Ikadami Loi Bala, others say that not. The Amila Bala, the ones that say that he did, then the reason Hadatumna, the reason why he preserved her in honey in the first place, Liasur Liatsre, because he wanted to satisfy his Yetzihara with her. The Amila Loi Bala, the version that says that he didn't. The only reason that he put her in the honey then, so people will see the body preserved and they'll think, look, he married a princess. We're going to talk about what developed from that, but it's information that we have to know. You should know, by the way, it's interesting, Josephus gives this girl a name. He says her name was Miriam, and he writes that Hordus had a couple of children with her, against our Gemara over here, which says that she killed herself before he could ever marry her. Later on, Josephus goes on to mention, Hordus was very paranoid, as we'll see from our Gemara as well. He ended up killing these sons late in life because he suspected them of rebelling against him. Anyway, what happened? What must have been the real thing based on our Gemara? They weren't really her children at all, but Hordus pretended that they were, precisely as the Gemara is saying over here. He pretended that he had married her and that he had children for her. He fooled him enough to fool Josephus, yeah? But our Gemara is telling us the fact. So it's important information to know. Yeah. Omar, now Hordus started thinking to himself. Man dorish mikerev achecha tatsim alach ha-melech. Who are the ones who darshan that when the Pasuk says, from among your brothers, you should appoint over yourselves a king, meaning it can't just be any yid, it has to be a yid who has yichus, it can't be an eved.
The Gemara is asking?
Hordus himself said to himself, who are the ones who say that that's the halacha?
Rabbanan.
That is the Rabbanan. Meaning, in other words, he's saying to himself, if it weren't for Torah Shabbat, if it weren't for the Chachamim explaining the Torah, everybody would think that I can be a legitimate king of the Jewish people. Look, I am, after all, a quasi-Jew. I am an Eved, and now, practically speaking, I'm free. I should, in theory, be able to be a king of the Jews, but the Rabbanan are going to oppose me because they're going to say that the Torah says that that's no good, and Eved can't be a king. Come Kaplinu Lakula Rabbanan, so he arose and killed all of the Rabbanan. Not all of the Rabbanan, Tosfos points out, there were some left, but by and large, he killed many of them. Shavkil Bavavin Buta L'mishkal Eitzimine. However, he left alive Bavavin Buta in order to get advice from him. He knew Bavavin Buta is a smart guy. He can use him as an advisor. However, even he didn't escape unscathed. Ahadale Klila Diyali. Hordus made him wear a crown made out of hedgehog skin, which has the quill sticking out of it. Nakrinul Ene, and that put out his eyes. So Bavavin Buta became blind.
All this that he did was after the kind of the construction.
This is before. This is all an introduction to that part of the story. Wait. Now, Kriyan Lainan, so he put out Bavaman Buddha's eyes.
Because?
Well, because even he wanted to make sure that he's not going to escape unscathed. But actually, the Ben Yehoyada says an interesting vort on it. Hordus had reason to be concerned. What if the Chachamim eventually regroup and reestablish the Sanhedrin with whatever Chachamim are left? And Bavaman Buddha, being so smart, they may well appoint him the new Nazi. Or they may at least appoint him to the Sanhedrin. A person can't be a member of the Sanhedrin if he has a mum, such as being blind. Therefore, that way he did that. Yeah. Interesting thing, by the way, that's brought in Sefer Gugulim is we know from our Gemara, we see from our Gemara that Bavaman Buddha was blind. We also know from various places in the Gemara that Rav Sheshis was blind. Rav Sheshis, the Amorah, was a Gugul of Bavaman Buddha. And thus, if you notice, in Atbash, if you take the word Bava in Atbash, it turns into Sheshis. Beis becomes Shin, Aleph becomes Tav. So there was a connection between them. Continues the Gemara. Yom Echad Osav Yosef Kameh. Now, one day, Hordus himself came and sat together with Bavaman Buddha. He wanted to test him and see whether he's loyal, after all. He starts off by saying, he pretended to be somebody else. I guess not. Besides, some people are
blind man.
Yes, some.
Very, very.
But sometimes a person, how often had he talked to Hordus before this? Besides, whatever, some people are good at disguising their voices. I don't know. Omar, so Hordus pretended. He pretended like he's just a regular person, some regular citizen who wants to complain about Hordus. He says, Chazimar, hi Avdabisha, my Kovin. Rebbe, look at what this bad slave is doing. You should do something about it. Amalei, so Bavaman Buddha tells him, my Evidlei, so what do you want me to do to him? Amalei, Nilati Emar. So Hordus, again, pretending to be a regular person to test him, says, you should curse him. Amalei, Bavaman Buddha says, can't. If you have a pasuk in Kehelet that says Gambamada Acha, even in your thoughts, Melech Al Tkalo, don't curse a king. Amalei, so he's a king. Yeah, practically speaking, he is. Amalei, so who just tells him, I love Melechu. This guy is not really a king. He's an Eved, after all, who's just ruling as a dictator. Amalei, so Bava Mubutu tells him, okay, well, I have Osher Ba'alma. Fine, if nothing else, he's rich. Uchdiv, and the pasuk there in Kehelet continues, over Chadre Mishkovcha al Tekalal Osher, even in your bedroom where you think you're in private, don't curse a rich person. And furthermore, V'lo Yehei El Amnasi, and even if you're going to say that all he is Amnasi, he's not maybe a legitimate king, but after all, he is a ruler. Uchdiv, and the pasuk says, V'nasi Ba'am Kolei Sar, and the pasuk says, a ruler among your people you should not curse. Amalei, so who does that? Yeah, well, not yet. He still wants to test him. Amalei, so Hordus tells him, he was a shtickle Talmud Chacham, apparently. He says, Ba'oitza Maisi Amcha. Okay, but you know that pasuk only applies to what it says, Amcha, meaning your people. It only applies to a person who acts like a Jew should act. Bahai Lav Oitza Maisi Amcha. This Hordus, this Rosh Hordus, this dictator, is not acting like Maisi Amcha. Okay, so that, the Bavaman Buddha doesn't have an answer to that. But Amalei, he says, this is Epinemine. Okay, maybe you have a point, maybe I should, but I'm afraid of him. And Hagoy Tabach had, somebody might go and inform him. And then I'll be in trouble. Amalei, so who just tells him, Laka Inish to Adul Delay Malay. There's nobody who'll tell it. Da'anova Atyasimne, it's just me and you together. Your secret is safe with me. Amalei, so Bavaman Buddha tells him, no. See, if you have another pasuk, it's back to back with that other pasuk in Kehelet, it's the next pasuk. Why shouldn't you curse a king or a rich person, even in private, even in your thoughts or whatever? Because even a bird of the heavens can transmit the voice. Or the winged creature can tell over. In other words, yes, there may not be people around here, but you know, a little bird told me it'll still leak out somehow anyway. Well, now Hordus saw that the Taka Bavaman Buddha has nothing against him. He's true to his principles. Amalei Anohu. So Hordus tells him, I'm he. I'm Hordus. I'm the king. Yehava Yadayna desired Abanan Kolahai. You know, if I'd realized that Abanan are so careful with this kind of thing, Lehavan Katilna, I wouldn't have killed them. Marsha, by the way, adds an interesting nuance over here. We know that Avodim are associated with Klala. Oru Knan, Evid Avodim Yelachavan doesn't mean Knan, but generally it means anyone who's an Evid Knan. Therefore, Hordus, to begin with, an Evid in general, yeah. Eliezer is Order. So therefore, Hordus figured, me being an Evid, that Abanan Mestama would want to curse me. Now that I see that Bavaman Buddha is careful enough that he's not, then I realize the other Abanan would have been just as careful, even though I'm an Evid, they still would decouple that from the Kala, and therefore I should have left them alone.
Was he careful? He just said, I'm afraid of people.
The fact of the matter is, he's saying, I'm not going to.
Did he know Bavaman Buddha before he killed them?
It, it, He knew him, but he didn't know until he had this whole conversation.
This is probably how he became the advisor. He went and did this.
No, maybe he was. Maybe he kept him around as an advisor before that. But this is the first time they actually had a long conversation. I don't know. Anyway, hashta maitakanti dahu gabra. So now Hoda says, what should that person, meaning me, do? What should I do to fix up the problem? Yeah, he's talking about himself in the third person.
They always do that.
Maitakanti dahu gabra. What should that person, meaning I, what should I do to fix it up? What should I do to make up for what I did? Amalei, so Bhagavan Buddha tells him like this. Who cover Oda Shalolam? You put out the light of the world. This is Tiner Mitzvah Torah, because we say a mitzvah is a candle and the Torah is light, and you remove Torah from the world by killing the Chachamim. Yelech v'yasek v'oda shaloylam. Therefore, you should go and involve yourself with the light of the world, which is the Beis Mikdash. Just v'naru elav kol ha-goyim. As it says, that all the goyim will go by the light of the Beis Mikdash. Naru, in context, it means that they'll all scream towards the Beis Mikdash, Lashon Nahar. But also, it's Lashon Nahora, which is Aramaic. It means light, so it means all the goyim will scream towards the light of the Beis Mikdash. Ikadamri, or another version is.
Nahar
means no, it can have two meanings. It can mean a river, therefore it can mean following, or it can mean light. Yeah. Ikadamri, another version is Hachi Amalei. The other version is that Bhagavan Buddha tells him like this. Husime Eina Shalolam, you blinded the eye of the world by killing the Chachamim. Dichtiv Bahaye Me'ene Eida, because the Pasuk calls the Chachamim the eyes of the community, because they showed us the right way to go. Yelech V'yisasek Me'ene Shalolam, therefore you should get involved with repairing and renovating the eye of the world, which is the Beis Mikdash, d'chtiv, as you have a pasuk that says, the Eibishta says to Yechezkel, hinini mechalas mikdashi, behold, I'm going to desecrate my Beis Mikdash, because the Beis Mikdash is going to be destroyed. This was before the first Torben. Go'in uschem, the strength of your power, machmadeinechem, and the beloved thing of your eyes. So we see that the Beis Mikdash is also, machman is the beloved thing, machemda, of your eyes. So we see the Beis Mikdash is associated with eyes. Marsha points out what the two different versions of it here, it basically boils down to Bhagavan Buddha is telling him there's two things that have been lost. The Chachamim themselves, who are like the eyes, and the Torah that they taught, which is like the earth. To fix up both of that is impossible for you. You've been too evil, you're not going to be able to do that. At least you can correct one of those two things. Which of the two aspects of it he's telling him to correct by renovating the Beis Mikdash, that's the two versions in the Gemara. Okay. Amalei, so who just tells him, Mr. Pinim Machosa, the same words that Bhagavan Buddha used a few lines ago, who just says, I'm afraid of the kingdom. Namely, Hurdus himself is basically a puppet king. He's ruling under the Romans. He's ruling Eretz Yisrael under the whim of the Romans.
He's afraid of the Romans.
Yeah, Machosa means the Romans. In other words, I don't have the right to unilaterally rebuild the Beis Mikdash. I need permission from them. Amalei. So Bhagavan Buddha tells him, Shada Shlicha, what you should do is send a messenger, yeah, of course, you have to ask permission, but make him take his time. The Lazel Shakta, let him take a year going there. Now, of course, it doesn't take a year normally to go from Eretz Yisrael to Rome, but whatever, you know, let him extend the trip.
Patience.
Yeah.
Going the short, long way.
Yes. The La'akav Shakta, let him take a year over there in Rome until he gets an audience with the emperor or the senate or whatever. The La'hedar Shakta, then it'll take him a year to get back. So you've got 3 years to work with. During that time, you'll have enough time to tear it down and rebuild it. And then by the time he comes back, whether the Romans say yes or no, it's a done deal already.
That's
what we're saying, because there were cracks in it, etc. Yeah. And we know Josephus gives a long, long description of how Argamotor gives a little bit of a description. He gives a fairly detailed description of all the various he expanded the size of the Harabayas and built it and built all kinds of new structures there.
Masechta
Midos describes the second Beis Mikdash, but basically it's describing what's required in the Beis Mikdash al pi halacha. It's not describing, for example, the various renovations and things that Hurdus did to it that are outside the precincts of the Beis Mikdash proper. It wasn't necessary.
It was necessary.
It would be nice for us to know, but it's not something that the halacha, we have to know the halacha of how the Beis Mikdash is supposed to look. Okay. So you got 3 years to work with, he tells him. One year to get there, 1 year till he gets an audience, whatever, and let them decide, and 1 year to get back. Okay. So sure enough, Hurdus did that. So when the Romans heard what happened, that he meanwhile had the chance to do this whole project without consulting with them, and they're like pretending that they sent him a message as follows. If you haven't yet torn it down, Altisto, don't tear it down. The imsatarta, if you already tore it down, al-tivni, don't rebuild it. The imsatarta over nisan, if you already tore it down and you rebuilt it, well, we can't do anything about it, but abdibisha, it means you're a bad slave. Basa de abdin mismalchin, what is it, you first do something and then you ask for permission? That's not the right way to do things. What do they care whether we tore it down or not, or rebuilt it or whatever? Marsha says an interesting verb. The Romans knew that, as the Gemara tells us in Gittin, that the Beis Mikdash could only be destroyed by a great world power. That's the Rabbi Yechon Zakkai tells Aspasianus that I know you've become the emperor because you're on the verge of destroying the Beis Mikdash, and that can only be done by a great emperor. So therefore,
he came to Yerushalayim.
Yeah, when he was besieging Yerushalayim, yeah. So the Romans are telling Herodotus, only a great world power like us has the ability to destroy the Beis Mikdash, not you who are just a king underneath us,
which is true.
So therefore, in other words, you don't even start by tearing it down. But if you did already, then don't rebuild it, because the build of the Beis Mikdash also has to be done by a king, and you're not really a king either. And if you did already, yeah. They continue, im zaynach halach, if your weapons are on you, meaning if you pride yourself on, I'm so expert with weapons, I was able to wipe out all the Hashmonaim, etc., don't worry, we'll put you in your place. Sifrach kan, your books, meaning your genealogy is here by us in Rome, and we know, la racha v'loi baracha, you're not a king, you're not the son of a king. Racha is by the racha means a king, we'll say in a second, a source for that in the pasuk, but it's also the Latin word for a king is rex, so it's related.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Yeah. You're not a king, you're not the son of a king, you're just Hurdus avda klanyim es abed, you're just Hurdus the eved who made himself free. So don't put on airs. Marsha also says a different vote on the Im Zayin HaChaloch. They say to him, you're thinking that there's two criteria a person needs to build a Beis Mikdash. Number one, he needs to be a king, and number two, he needs to be at peace with all his enemies. He needs to be at peace around all his enemies. That's why David couldn't build a Beis Mikdash, only Shlomo could. So fine, the peace all around you that you have. So fine, Im Zayin HaChaloch, fine. But don't think that you're a king. You're nothing but an enemy.
He has his weapon on him.
No, but in other words, by now, by the time all this happened, this was in the middle of Herodotus' reign already, he had gotten rid of all of his internal and external enemies.
So
they're telling him, you think that therefore you have the right to rebuild the Beis Mikdash. Fine, peace you have, but a king? Oh, you're a king. You're not a king. You're just an enemy.
Yahai HaMelech and Herodotus killed out all the Rabbanan, and they were...
Also true, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, both of them died are Yom Tov and Megillah Sinus.
If that's the case, that he's not a king, didn't they get very upset that he killed Rabbanan without asking them permission?
No.
Did they know about it?
Maybe they knew about it, but okay, look, even if he's a puppet king, fine, he has the right to dispose of whatever enemies he wants as long as they're not citizens of Rome, you know.
But cause a rebellion?
I guess they weren't concerned about that. You want to deal with a rebellion in your kingdom, fine, but to do a major
that
could also be, I don't know. Yeah, he may have also gotten permission,
after
who knows.
The uprising.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, you could have always claimed I'm putting down an uprising, whatever, yeah. It's interesting, by the way, Josephus mentions also in his own style that there was a period of time after Herodotus renovated the Beis Mikdash when the Romans snubbed him for a while. We see some more of the background of that.
He doesn't say in those words,
but still, the idea was that they were very unhappy with him that he's taking the initiative too much, that he's becoming too independent. Okay.
He's getting too religious.
He's getting too big for his britches, basically. Okay. My racha, when we say that you're not a racha and you're not a bar racha, what is racha? It means machosa, means a king. Dichtiv, as we have a pasuk where David says on himself, Anochi Hayem Rach Moshuach Melech. Today I am Rach and anointed as a king. So we see that Rach is a word related to kingship. Or another source you can have for it, Vayikru in front of Avreich, where it says by Yosef that they announced in front of him Avreich, and one meaning of Reich over there is king. Rashi mentions it on the pasuk also, and quotes our Gemara in that connection. Now we see that Avreich means the father, like the advisor to the king. Amen. So they say, the Chachamim say, Mishalei Ra Binyan Hurdus Lei Ra Binyan Naam Yama. Famous thing, it's also in Sukkah. Anyone who did not see Hurdus' building, his renovation of the Beis Mikdash, never saw a really beautiful building in his life. The Mai Banye, what did he build the building with? Omer Rabba Ba'avne Shisha Umarmara. He used for it Shayish, which actually says is green marble, and Marmara, white marble.
The
Hechel we're talking about. Ikadamri, or other versions say that he built it Avne Kuchala Shisho Mamura. He used those two colors as well as Kuchala, which is blue. So either white and green or blue, white and green. Apik
such thing as blue marble?
I guess so. I don't know. bluish, I don't know. Yeah. Apik Sof of Isle Sofer, he made the alternate rows of stones go in and out, so it was like this on the side. In order that afterwards he could put plaster on top of it, which then he would use that plaster Sover the Mishie Bedava. He figured that he can use that plaster as a base for plating the whole thing with gold. So you'll have the marble, then you can't put gold directly on stone, right, or on stick, so therefore you need plaster. Yeah.
That's why
he had the marble.
So he had marble, then he was going to cover that with plaster, and then on top of that, he was going to put gold.
So why even put marble?
Because he was big on building. He wanted to build things.
But he never got the gold.
Well, that's what we're going to say now. Amrulay Rabbanan. So Rabbanan, apparently by that time there were enough Rabbanan around again to tell him. Yeah, they told him, Shavke, leave it alone. Don't put on plaster or gold. Dehochi Shafut Fei. It's much nicer this way. Demechti Ki Idvasidiyama. It looks like the waves of the sea. When you look at this building with this pattern of blue and red, and not red, blue and green and white, it looks wavy. It looks like the waves of the sea. Yeah. And Marshall points out also the significance of the deeper significance. The deeper significance of that is also that the sky is blue, and that represents the Kisei HaKavod. So to have a bluish Beis HaMikdash which resembles the waves of the sea would put a person more in mind of the of Shemayim of the Kisei HaKavod, which is as it should be. Okay. Now, so that's the story of how Hur just came to renovate the Beis HaMikdash. Now, we have to ask, Bava ben Buta, Heche Oved Hachi. Aside from, we dealt with the question before how Bava ben Buta was allowed to tell him to tear down the Beis HaMikdash and rebuild it, because what about the Din by a Shul? Now we're going to look at it from a different angle. How does Bava ben Buta give advice to a Rosha like Hurdus to atone for his Avera of killing the Chachamim by rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash? How are you allowed to give a Rosha an Eitza how to get out of his punishment? He had a Baskel, very nice. Doesn't mean that he had to go and kill them all. Baskel didn't say anything about killing the Chachamim anyway. The Baskel said that any slave who's successful in rebelling against his master is fine. Okay, if he's going to kill out the Chashmonaim, that's one thing. But to kill out the Chachamim, that he didn't have any excuse for. The question is, how did Bava ben Buta have the ability to tell him in the first place to do such a positive thing? Why shouldn't he let Hurdus stew in his own juices and end up getting punished for his Aveda? Of killing the Chachamim.
Well,
Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Vitamer of Yeshua ben Levi, Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, or some say Rav Yeshua ben Levi said, Mipnei ma nenesh Daniel, why was Daniel punished? How he was punished, we'll see in a few lines. Mipnei shehisi eitzel Nebuchadnezzar, because he gave advice to Nebuchadnezzar how to get out of his punishment. Shenemar, what happened was, as it says in the pasuk, the background is like this. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. So we all know about the dream with the statue, with the head of gold, etc. This is a separate. He had another dream some time later. He had a dream sometime later. He saw this gigantic, beautiful tree where all of a sudden a malach comes down from Shemayim and announces, chop down the tree, and the stump of it should be tied up with chains and left like that for 7 years among all the animals and whatever. It's in Daniel, Perek Daled. So Nebuchadnezzar at least remembered the dream, unlike the previous one, but still he had no idea what it meant. None of his advisors or astrologers or what have you had any idea either. He calls in Daniel. Daniel explains to him, the tree represents you. You are like a tree that supports the whole earth because you're the superpower, but you've become too proud. You think you run the world rather than the Eibishter. So now the Eibishter is going to cut you down to size. You are going to be sent, or you're going to go crazy, and you're going to go live among the animals in the forests for 7 years until you... No, Nebuchadnezzar had respected him and his advice. He said it a little more respectfully than that, but whatever, that was the gist of it. So he tells him that's what it means. Eventually, at the end of the 7 years, you'll realize that the Eibishter is boss, and then you'll come back to your kingdom. Now, Daniel tells him the pasuk that we're going to quote over here. L'chein malka, therefore, king, milki yishvar alach, let my advice be acceptable to you. V'chatoyach b'tzedakah pruk, you should atone for your chatoyim with tzedakah, v'ava yosach b'meichan anoyin, and your deliberate avedus you should atone for by being kind to the poor. Hein tevi alko l'shlevsach, that way there'll be an extension for your peaceful time. He's giving him advice, and with do tzedakah, and that way your punishment will be deferred. The Gemara. Uchtiv, and the next pasuk continues, Kolam Matal Nebuchadnezzar Malka. All of this indeed happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Uchtiv, the next pasuk continues, Kas Yachin Trei Asa Vagoyma, after 12 months. So the Medrash says during those 12 months, Taka, he did give the Daka, and therefore his punishment was deferred. The end of the 12 months, one day he's walking on the roof of the palace, he sees beautiful Babel. Look at this beautiful city that I built for my glory, and boom, Bastol comes from Shemayim and says, that's it, Nebuchadnezzar, you're out of here. So we see that his punishment was deferred for a year by him giving tzedakah. And Daniel was punished for giving him that advice. How he was punished, we'll see in a couple of lines. So again, back to the question, how does Bava ben Butta advise a Rasha like Purdus to get out of his punishment, of his well-deserved punishment? How is he advising Hurdus to get out of his well-deserved punishment by building the Beis HaMikdash? How does he have a right to do that? So, Iboy Seim Hashayni Avdadi Chayiv HaMitzvahs. One answer is you could say Hurdus is not a goy like a Mahamatzer. He is an Eved. He's Chayiv in certain mitzvahs, building the Beis HaMikdash being one of them. So therefore, it's a legitimate thing to tell him. He could have found some way out of it, whatever. He was
gone.
As a matter of fact, actually, it's interesting that Rambam writes that everybody is obligated to build a Beis HaMikdash on Noshim Noshim Batach, except for Tinokas Rabbi Tzirabon. Some Mephoshim on the Rambam say that Rambam got that from here. Avodim are chayiv in the same mitzvah as women are chayiv in. If we're saying over here that Hurdus as an Eved is chayiv to build a Beis HaMikdash, it follows that Jewish women are too.
And that's the halacha?
That's the way that Rambam asks him, that, yeah, that women are just as much chayiv in the building of the Beis HaMikdash as men. Yeah, it's not a mitzvah. Avodim have the same basic dinim as women. Avodim can't, I mean. Okay. That's one answer. The boy say a shiny Beis HaMikdash, or another answer is it's different when it comes to building Beis HaMikdash. Dilei Malchus leMispin. If you don't have the power and the resources of a king behind it, it's never going to get done. Again, given that we said before that Bava ben Butta saw the building is structurally unsound anyway, if that's what it takes, if it requires giving advice to a Rasha like Hurdus, if he's the only one who has the resources to do it, okay, it's going to have to happen. Okay. The Daniel Minolan Dianesh, so now we have to ask, where do we see that Daniel was punished? You could say that it's because, based on the Pasuk in Megillas Esther, that Esther called Hasach, but Omar Rav Hasach is Daniel, and Rav says that Hasach is identical with Daniel. Well, you can, that only works. That only works according to the opinion that he was renamed Hasach because Chaschuhu, he was cut down from his greatness. Previously, in the Rashi points out Belshazzar, after he saw the writing on the wall, appointed Daniel, he appointed him over one third of the kingdom. Later on also, earlier we find he had been one of Nebuchadnezzar's top advisors. Later on, he was still one of the important advisors in the times of Dariush. By the time it comes to Esther, he's not any of that anymore. He's just one of the servants in the palace, and Esther is sending him back and forth to Mordechai. So according to that, then you see that's how he was punished, that he lost his high position. Hasach, Daniel. Hasach was saying is Daniel.
Oh.
Why was he renamed Hasach? One reason is, he was cut down from his greatness. For all that time, he had been a high official in the government. Now, all of a sudden, he's just a page boy over there. So that's, yeah. But there's another version in Gemara Megillah that why was he called Hasach? Because he still had his high position. All of the things that had to be done by the government were all decided based on him, meaning he still had his high position. So according to that, Michael Neymar, what are you going to say? Where do we see that he was punished? And the answer is, yes, but there was the fact that he was thrown into the lion's den. He was saved from it, but still, the fact that he had to go through that whole experience was because of this advice that he gave to Nebuchadnezzar. Tosfos, by the way, points out there is a third opinion, which is that if we say that Hasach is Daniel, there's a third opinion, according to which it comes out that he really did end up suffering a severe punishment. You have in the Megillah over there in Perek Daled, Esther and Mordechai are going back a couple of times, back and forth with Hasach. All of a sudden, you have over there when Esther says, I can't go, I haven't been told in 30 days, the Pasuk says, Vayagid du le Mordechai Esther and Esther. They told Mordechai what Esther said. Who's the they? What happened to Hasach? So Tosfos brings Tosfos brings from the Targum over there that what happened was when Haman saw Hasach going back and forth, he suspected that something's going on and he had Hasach killed, and therefore other people had to deliver the message. If we say, as Or Gemara is saying, that Hasach is Daniel, it comes out he attacked that he was killed by Haman. Yeah. However, Tosfos says Or Gemara evidently disagrees with that, and not only that, so does the Gemara in Megillah, because the Gemara in Megillah gives a different answer to that question. The Gemara says, why didn't Hasach deliver that mass message? She'ein meshivin al kakala. She's telling him, I don't want to do it. Hasach didn't want to deliver such a message, so therefore he left it to somebody else.
Now, because
everything was decided according to him, yeah.
And so he was still running around.
But he still had a high government position, yeah. We are fine.
We're talking to,
I guess that's true also, yeah. The Mishnah had said, the Mishnah had said, "Akol kaminig ha-medina," that when we build a wall between the two halves of the chatzer, then everything is done according to the minig ha-medina. So the question is, "Hakol l'asur yamai," what does the word "hakol" come to include? The answer is l'asur yamai in the higi b'chutz of a dafna. It comes to include, suppose you have the kind of place where the local minig is not to build stone or brick walls at all, but rather just to build a wall out of chutz of a dafna. Chutz means palm branches. Dafna means laurel branches. So like they weave together not a house. I didn't say a house. A wall in a courtyard. If their local minig is that a wall for that purpose, a privacy wall, that they make it out of branches that are woven together, since it's still enough to block one person from seeing to the other, that's an acceptable thing. And then if that's the local minig, I mean, the other one can't say, no, I don't want stone or brick or whatever. Then we said the Mishnah had said, so that therefore if the wall fell down, then since they built it jointly in the first place, then now the space and the stones belong to both of them. So the question is, Pshita, well, obviously they built it together, then of course the stones belong to both of them. So Rashi himself explains the question is, we would assume that when the wall fell down, the stones probably fell evenly, half and half on each side. So why would we think that, of course, each one has half of it in his part of the cluster? Of course they divide it. Then you have in Rashi over here, there's an interpolation from Rabbeinu Hananel that says we could be talking about not even necessarily, even if they're all in the part of one of them. We learned at the end of Bava Basra, that usually Shukfim don't mind for a while one person having his stones in the other one's chatzer. So even if they all fell into one person's chatzer, the question is obviously we shouldn't assume just because they're in his chatzer he has a chazak on them. We would assume since they were Shukfim to begin with, And Tosfos, at the beginning of the Masechta, explains a nuance on top of that. Tosfos says maybe we're even talking about, let's say the stones are sitting there for a couple of weeks. So that's that's the answer. Rather, Tosfos says that's the answer. The Mishnah needs to inform us in the case, the Nafal Rishus of the Chad Minayu. Suppose it fell into the Rishus of only one of them. Which again, according to these various explanations, each in their own way, but according to Tosfos, it means even if they were sitting there for a couple of weeks, it still doesn't mean that I can say, well, now they were sitting by me a couple of weeks, therefore I have a chazaka on them, you or Miyash, or whatever. No. If the guy gave them to you, but not otherwise. Or let's say one of them cleared them all into his part of the rishut. You would think, without our Mishnah saying so, that maybe in that case we would apply the rule amotz mechaver levadaya. For mashmalon, that is the chiddush, we don't do that. And one of the instead we always split it 50-50 because we assume to begin with that the wall was probably built according to the specifications in our Mishnah that they each had to provide half the land and half the stone. And by the way, one of the Rishonim, I don't remember now which one, says another nuance on this, that what it means is, even let's say, for example, now we looked at the beginning of Bava Metzia, suppose you have two people arguing over the talus. One says Kula Shali and one says Chetia Shali. What happens after they both switter? One ends up with 3/4 of the talus and one ends up with 1/4 of it. What would happen in our case? Let's say one of them claimed all the stones and the other one claimed only half of them. Maybe you should apply the same thing. No, come on, our Mishnah tells us it's not like that. 50-50 no matter what, because the difference is over there. We don't know. Maybe one of them picked it up first, maybe not. Here we know, we assume that to begin with, the wall was built according to specifications, half from one, half from the other, yes. Obviously, unless we know otherwise, yeah. To be continued tomorrow.